Hi again, I'm Jerry Barmash, and this is Hear Now the News. This episode comes to you as the Electoral College gathers to finalize the presidency for Joe Biden. President Trump was dealt a final blow when the Supreme Court refused to hear arguments in a Texas lawsuit, with several other states attached and 126 Republican lawmakers in Congress. That would have effectively overturned four pivotal states needed for Trump to win. Today I'm talking to Brendan Keefe, a TV reporter at Atlanta's 11 Alive. Georgia is the center of the political universe these days, as two Senate runoffs are coming next month. All that's at stake is control of the Senate, with the Republicans currently holding a 50-48 edge. But if the Democrats take the incumbent seats, the tie in baseball may go to the runner. But here, it's the Democrats, with Vice President-elect Kamala Harris breaking the deadlock. Brendan and I spoke just as the Texas lawsuit was announced. Joining me here now, the news, I'm pleased to have from 11 Alive in Atlanta, Brendan Keefe. I got to know you on Twitter. I mean, you are just extraordinary with, of course, Atlanta has been the center of the political world and continues to do. First of all, thanks for joining me today.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks, Jerry.
So what do you make of the, I guess we'll start with the political climate right now?
Yeah, we live in interesting times, right? Which is the blessing for any journalist. It also means we've been working around the clock. I mean, this year, 2020, it's become hyperbole, but it's lived up to its billing, from protests, COVID, now the elections that will never end. It's just been extraordinary. And Georgia, you know, there really just wasn't anybody here. Even though there was this talk of Georgia becoming a swing state, they've been talking about it for a decade. This time it rang true, and it also became this disputed election. And there just wasn't an apparatus here other than CNN, which is largely decamped from Atlanta and is now really a New York operation. They just didn't have an operation here, any of the networks or newspapers. So suddenly there was this vacuum of information. And every tweet I would send out, where I only had 5,400 followers after a decade, every tweet I would send out would just, it would be like that spinning odometer, like you see on these blue check mark accounts. And I realized that people needed more information. I just started sending more out. And now I'm up to 48,000-49,000 followers just because of filling that void.
And I noticed that here in New York, just looking, not even doing anything with it, we wanted the information. And you seem to be, and I'm sure there were other reporters that were out there, obviously, print and radio and TV. But you seem to be, we were gravitating to it because you seem to be putting a lot of information, obviously a lot of accurate information out there. Is it difficult to give the information when you know the president is, if not looking at yours, but is, you know, is counteracting everything that's being said?
Yeah, I mean, the president retweeted me just last week. And immediately my phone was blowing up, figuratively, of course, but I mean, very close to in reality, because, you know, the president has an extraordinary audience, an immediate access like no other president has to millions of people. So when he retweeted one of the things I had tweeted out, which was that video of the Georgia elections official, Gabriel Sterling, basically chastising his fellow Republicans, clearly, the president had not watched the video because it was highly critical of him. I think he just saw that it was trending and my tweet was at the top of the trend, and he simply hit reply and retweeted it with his own comments. So, no, it's been extraordinary. I think the big thing is, you know, you and I are old enough to remember when, you know, the New York Times had bureaus all over the world and even all over New York. They had them, and, you know, there was a Poughkeepsie bureau, and, you know, there was a bureau out in Suffolk County and that kind of thing. And most of the newspapers, websites, and networks don't have those extensive bureaus anymore. And just having the local knowledge of what the Georgia law was and who the players were, that just gave me the ability to immediately respond to breaking news in a way that just the national folks couldn't.
Certainly, when you have that audience getting in there, have you had any negative replies?
Oh, yeah, a lot. I shared a few, and then our bosses, for security reasons, asked me to stop sharing them and to even delete the tweets that were sharing some of the threats. I mean, literally death threats.
Oh.
I mean, in words I can't repeat even in a podcast. And I've really come to see them. You know, you have to have a thick skin as an investigative reporter anyway. I mean, you're not doing your job unless you're upsetting someone. But when people direct things at you and in, you know, every journalist, particularly those on air, you know, have an inferiority complex deep down. And so when someone tells you, you suck in very colorful terms, it's hard not to take it personally. But it also shows we're doing something right. And obviously we have to take security precautions, but yeah, I mean, there's a guy across the country who lost his job because he happened to send a threatening email to me using his work email. And you know, father of two lost his job because, you know, he shouldn't have done that. The stakes are very high. They're high for the country. They're high for us as journalists individually. And they're certainly high for those who would threaten our lives.
I should point out, you said chief investigative reporter, I should say, you are for the station. It is 11 Alive, WXIA, if you're in Atlanta, or I guess we can, of course, see you streamed. I guess we could find it online.
Yeah, I do. We do a weekly show here that's on hiatus for the elections. It's called The Reveal. You can find it at thereveal.tv. That will take you to our YouTube playlist. It's a weekly local investigative show. What we do is systemic and institutional failures. So these aren't the seven things in your sock drawer that can kill you investigations. They're real in-depth investigations that create change, that get laws passed, that put corrupt officials in prison. That's what we do. And we have an extensive team. We have four on-air investigative journalists and a team of eight people working on this investigative show. And of course, you can see me on Twitter at Brendan Keefe.
Right. I was going to mention that. It's the place to be. I mean, as you said, before the election, you were at under 5,000 and now you're at 50,000 at least.
Yeah, it was 5,400. And now, I mean, literally while we're on this this podcast, it will grow by another few hundred. It's just if during the election, and it's nothing to do with me, it's the information, right? So right. I just saw this vacuum of information that people were starving for it. All I was tweeting were results. I wasn't opining on what I thought was going on. I was just saying the latest Georgia numbers. And as they just kept whittling down Trump's lead as the absentee ballots were counted, every time I would tweet, it would get retweeted and it would be retweeted by some people I follow. And so it became this sort of exponential growth. And I was gaining 1,000 followers an hour on election night.
Back to the death threats. I mean, you have a family. I saw the dog a moment ago. Is it disconcerting for you and your family?
Of course it is. I mean, we follow some fairly standard protocols. You know, our kids are so good at locking the door that they've locked us out of the house. I've locked my wife out of the house when she's on the deck because it's like putting your seatbelt on. I know a locked door isn't the only thing, but all of my cars and driver's license all are registered to the TV station. The only thing that's registered to the house is our voting record because that's the law. Of course, we're registered to vote where we live, but everything else, similar to a police officer, the address goes back to the TV station. So they're just some standard protocols. If someone really wants to hurt you, there's nothing you can do to stop them, but you can harden the target.
I also want to ask you a term that we've been hearing in recent weeks from the president primarily, the term massive dump, which in several states there were, I think all from the mail-in votes and predominantly 70, 80% were in favor of Biden. And this has been the crux of these legal claims in Pennsylvania, Georgia, and everywhere else. What can you explain about that?
So there's two things. One, this was my eighth presidential election. I was sitting in Austin, Texas on November 7th, 2000, when George W. Bush did not come out to accept the presidency because it ended up at the Supreme Court. So this isn't my first rodeo, as they'd say down in Texas. And I can tell you that working election nights, these so-called massive dumps happen in every election. They're predominantly from the larger counties because of just the mere size of them. You've got multiple precincts. You've got a lot of information coming in. They're usually the last to report. And when they do report, it doesn't mean they counted this huge number of ballots all at once. It means that they wait until they get a certain number of data and then they upload it in batches. When those batches hit, it tends to move the needle significantly. And every election night I've ever worked, we've seen things swing based on those results. What's unique about this election is COVID. So we had a large portion of the voting population choose to vote absentee. Georgia has no excuse absentee ballot, absentee balloting, absentee voting. So all you have to do is request that ballot. And if you request it online, you have to show your driver's license number and your birth date. If you request it by paper, it's by a signature match. Then they send you the ballot, and then you send it back with a signature on the envelope, which has become an important topic we can talk about as well in terms of trying to audit that. But the important thing to point out is that the vast majority of Georgians did not vote on election day. Most voted what they call absentee early, which is in-person voting, similar to election day, but they call it absentee in person. That's how I voted. I voted early, a couple of weeks before the election. And one out of four Georgia voters voted by absentee ballot. And that very largely skewed toward Democrats because the president had told people that the absentee ballots couldn't be trusted. So a large number of Republicans did not request them. We know that. We don't know how they voted, but we do know that comparatively fewer Republicans requested absentee ballots, whereas many, many more Democrats did. So by definition, you would expect to see more Democratic votes in those votes that were counted later. Another important thing to point out is that the absentee ballots in Georgia, they can be processed before Election Day. That means the signatures can be verified, they can be opened, and they can be sort of collated. They just can't be counted until Election Day.
Signature, that's been a really a big issue for the Trump camp, or at least it's pivoted to that. And it's confusing because it almost seems like they're looking at something for future elections. You can't change the rules, it would appear, once the game is over. What is the issue with the signature, matching the signatures?
It's largely misunderstood. So a lot of the absentee laws, including the one in Georgia, were passed before voter ID. So a lot of states have added voter ID, like Georgia. I have to show my identification, a photo government ID, or a passport or a state ID card in order to vote in person. But the absentee signature request was passed in Georgia in 2005. So it's a 15-year-old law. And what's interesting is David Schaefer, the head of the Georgia GOP, who's now suing the state of Georgia Secretary of State, along with President Trump as his co-plaintiff, he actually voted for this law that he's saying now shouldn't be the law. But he made no efforts to change it until he didn't like the result. He made no efforts to change it while members of his own party were winning year after year. It was only the first year they lost, you know, this statewide election that he's challenging the law he voted for, which is interesting. But here's what it says. So there's a huge misunderstanding with signatures in Georgia. In fact, I spend, without exaggeration, an hour a day simply responding to people saying the signatures were never checked. It's just not true. In order to get an absentee ballot, as I mentioned, they don't send you a ballot automatically in Georgia unless you're elderly, in which case you can register to have one sent automatically. That's the only exception. Otherwise, you have to request it. They check your name against the voter rolls, and they check your signature on the paper absentee ballot application with the one on file. They have a paper copy, but they also have an image, and then they also have access to the Department of Motor Vehicles here. It's a Department of Driver Services, they call it. They have the signature that you have on your driver's license or state ID card to match it. And if there's any disputes, there's a three-person dispute team who can look at it, one Republican, one Democrat, and one staffer from the elections office. And then once they do that, they send you the absentee ballot, and you have to sign the absentee ballot, and the signature is checked again. As I mentioned before, if you request it online, there is no signature, but you have to put in your driver's license number or state ID number and your birth date. Now, your birth date may be easy to find online, but your state ID or driver's license number is not public record in Georgia. So this would be very difficult to fake. And then you'd also have to sign the absentee ballot, which is then checked again. The signature is on the envelope that you return your ballot in. And inside that is another envelope that's blank that just says official absentee ballot. And so the person processing the signature cannot see the ballot. And this is important because you'd say, oh, well, someone who works on the staff who favors Biden could say, oh, well, this is a Trump ballot. I'm gonna reject this signature. Oh, this is a Biden ballot, but the signature doesn't match. I'm gonna let this one in.
Right.
They cannot see the ballot inside. It's inside two envelopes at that point. The envelope with the signature and the security envelope, the privacy envelope inside. Once they separate those two, they'll actually verify the signature and they say, okay, good, this ballot's good. And then they take that privacy envelope and someone else will actually process the ballot and count it. So those are two separate processes, the openers who are verifying the signature and the people counting the ballots. And the openers who are verifying the signatures cannot see the ballot inside. So every single one of the ballots in Georgia that were absentee, the signature was verified twice, or it was verified once plus driver's license number and birth date. You cannot go back and audit this after the fact because yes, the envelopes are kept for 2 years, but all you can do is see how many of them didn't match. And again, it's subjective. Someone could say, well, I think it matches. And someone else could say, I think it doesn't. That's why I think Georgia is going to change the law going forward. But as it stands now, there is no way to match that ballot back to that envelope. It cannot be done because under the Georgia Constitution, your ballot is secret. It's a secret ballot so that your vote can't be purchased. Because if someone could check to see you actually voted a certain way, they could then verify to pay you off for your vote. And that's why under the Georgia Constitution, it is impossible to match these signatures back to the ballots at this stage. It cannot be done.
So it would appear, and I underscore appear, that and we'll stick with Georgia because that's where, you know, the focus is right here. But between recounts and even I believe the state legislature, right, they've had hearings and everything has been certified, right?
That's correct. It's been certified and now recertified after all 159 counties have certified through their boards. And then the state secretary of state has certified and the governor has affixed the state seal on the slate of Biden electors,
which would take us to next week, as we're recording this on December 8th, would take us to December 14th, when the natural progression would be the meeting of the Electoral College.
And that will happen at the Georgia State Capitol for Georgia's 16 electors.
But then I heard today that, and this is an odd one, and I'm sure you heard this, that the state of Texas is looking to, I don't know if sue is the right word, but looking to bring several battleground states to the Supreme Court, including Georgia.
Yeah, so Texas, the Attorney General of Texas, who himself is under criminal investigation, has filed a lawsuit. It's an odd lawsuit. You're right. Do you call it suing? Do you not? He's basically asked the Supreme Court permission to sue these battleground states. And it's kind of an interesting avenue. They clearly are reverse engineering all of this, right? You start with fraud, but you have no evidence. So let's say, okay, we think there's fraud. So now let's go look for evidence to prove it instead of looking for evidence and then based on what you find. So it's already conclusion selective. It's confirmation bias. Everything they see is sort of fitting the narrative that took place. And then they're also, by the way, when I say they, I mean the people who are accusing fraud are saying you have to prove that Joe Biden's 80 plus million votes are legitimate or it's fraud. That's not how it works. You don't have to disprove fraud. You don't have to prove a negative. What
Trump has said that he's tweeted fraud. That. Yeah, Trump
exactly. He's tweeted exactly that Joe Biden can't enter the White House unless he proves that his votes are authentic. But they found an interesting avenue in that instead of having to go through the lower courts and then the appeals courts and then the Supreme Court, which there isn't enough time to get there. And they've got a couple of avenues. It looks like the Pennsylvania, they're going to try to get cert from the Supreme Court for the Pennsylvania case. But as it stands right now, they found this interesting avenue where if one state sues another state or states, disputes between the states have to go to the Supreme Court because a lower court cannot hear disputes between states. So it's this interesting little legal, I don't want to call it a loophole, it's an avenue where if states sue states, you can go to the Supreme Court without going to the lower court. That's what they've done. So they've sued just these battleground states, including Georgia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, etc. And the idea is interesting. They're arguing, Texas is arguing that its standing is that the vice president may be the tie-breaking vote in the Senate. And therefore, Texas is injured somehow if Texans don't have a say in who that vice president is, because the vice president's the president of the Senate and would have the tie-breaking vote if the Senate ends up split 50-50, which is an interesting argument. Most legal scholars are looking at this saying this doesn't have a chance, but it's also 2020 and the court is 6-3 with right. three of those six conservative justices having been appointed by the president, President Trump.
Right, right. And it would seem that this is, if not this particular one, but he's been kind of eyeing this moment with the Supreme Court. Obviously, Amy Coney Barrett is now there. So it would seem that that's obviously that would be his last chance.
You know, what's interesting is I think this will be studied. Obviously, this will be studied for generations longer than you and I will be alive. But I think there will be analysis that the U.S. court system, let's face it, the judicial branch gets short shrift when people talk about the three branches of government. There are three co-equal branches of government, legislative, executive, and judicial. And the judicial branch is kind of misunderstood. It's kind of seen as sort of the last resort when the other two don't agree. But they each have checks and balances on each other, without turning this into a civics class. Even though some new elected members of Congress think the three branches are the House, the Senate, and the presidency, not the case,
right?
As we've seen. But here's what I'm thinking is going to be studied for generations is that the judiciary has saved democracy. And I don't care who wins the election as a journalist. What I care about is that, you know, we still are a democratic republic with a informed electorate. That's kind of what I've dedicated my life to, right? Mm-hmm. And the judiciary, what they have done is they've said, no, it doesn't matter that I was appointed by George W. Bush or Donald Trump or Barack Obama. I'm going to rule on the law. And, you know, at these justices, even at the Supreme Court, even though some of them were selected because of their ideology and their past rulings, at heart, they love the law and they love the Constitution more than anything else. And they have taken their oaths seriously. We may disagree with some of their opinions, but I don't think there's anyone currently sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court who would rule against sort of their love of the law and their belief in the Constitution. And what's interesting, the justices that, not to turn this into a con law class, but the justices that Donald Trump appointed, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett, are all sort of originalists and federalists and constitutionalists. They believe sort of in this government should stay out of your life and that the Constitution is written to make sure that happens and the Constitution constrains government and that also it is not a living document that can be interpreted in modern times. It needs to be applied to modern times in the way the founders, you know, intended. Which is my long-winded way of saying that I don't think any of these current cases has a chance at the Supreme Court. And I doubt they'll even grant cert, which in other words, I doubt they'll hear the case, any of these cases.
Right.
I just don't even think, and I think that's their easiest way out of this, but it's also probably the most prudent given the evidence we've seen so far.
And on top of all of this, there's a campaign for two Senate elections. The two runoffs that are special elections that are happening in less than a month, January 6th, right? Is it January?
It's January 5th. January 6th is actually when Congress will open the electoral votes.
Right. Okay.
Which is interesting. So it's the day after. If hopefully 2021 will not be like 2020, if it is, the January 5th runoff elections in Georgia will go on for weeks. but these are runoff elections. There's a history in Georgia of runoff elections. In one of the U.S. Senate races, it was essentially an anybody can enter nonpartisan primary. So there were multiple people running for the Loeffler Senate seat, basically. It got down to the two highest vote getters. If one of them had gotten more than 50% plus one vote, they would be the next senator. But that was expected to go a runoff. We didn't expect Senator Perdue and John Ossoff to go to a runoff, and it is because neither of them got 50% plus one vote. Georgia's unique in that. I think there's only two states that still do this, and it actually goes back to the civil rights movement and to the Voting Rights Act, because Georgia, and it goes back even farther than that, didn't want, and this is absolutely verifiable fact, they didn't want black voters to be able to sort of elect their own representatives. They wanted there to be, okay, if we have this sort of minority of Black voters voting as a monolithic group, which they never do, but if they did, we would, that would just pick one of the candidates and our candidate would still win. Mm-hmm. And so it really has a racist
overtone,
genesis, yeah, of where it came from. But that's why we have two Senate runoffs. And so but what's interesting is that right now it's 48-50 in the Senate, where the Republicans have 50 seats and the Democrats plus independents who caucus with them have 48. So if these two seats go to the Democrats, you have a 50-50 split in the U.S. Senate, with Vice President Harris breaking all ties, which means all of the committee chairmanships, all of the what comes to the floor would be up to the Democrats. But even if one of these seats goes to Republicans, then you're going to have Republican control retained, but it's going to be by a razor thin margin.
And even though the president hasn't conceded, I saw when he was in Georgia the other night, he sort of alluded to it. If you kind of read between the lines, or if you have your little decoder ring, you could actually figure out that it was sort of a concession, at least in the president's terms, because he was there campaigning for both Republican candidates. And he kind of said that we need to win to have control of the Senate, which, if they were to win the White House, they wouldn't need that, because even as a tie, they would have Pence breaking the tie anyway, right?
Yeah, it's an interesting way of putting it. I mean, I think that you have the administration talking out of both sides of its mouth right now. These Senate races, there's all of this discussion over how much is this fight, this futile fight, as it turns out, to overturn the election, how much is that going to hurt the Republicans running in the Senate race? There are extremists within the party, some of whom have the ear of the voters. I mean, more than, you know, Newt Gingrich posted, hey, you know, you should turn out and vote for Republicans. I'm sitting right now in what was Newt Gingrich's district, and it is currently, that seat is currently held by a Black woman Democrat who's fighting for gun control. Who would have thought, if you don't believe Georgia's changed, Newt Gingrich's district now has a Black woman Democrat fighting for gun control. Mm-hmm. So that kind of puts things in perspective. But when Newt Gingrich came out the other day and said, you know, you really should vote for these two Republican senators, Republicans here in Georgia jumped on him and said, you know, you're irrelevant, and we're listening to these more extreme voices in the party now. So Newt Gingrich is too moderate for the Georgia Republican Party. And you've got other voices out there like David Schaefer, the party chair here in Georgia, and Lynn Wood, the sort of famed defamation attorney. It's funny to use famed and defamation in the same sentence, but you know, he represented Richard Jewell and Sandman up in Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky, more recently. And he is saying, don't vote in the primary, that if the system is rigged and the current Republican governor and Republican secretary of state won't fight for you and for the president, then, you know, these two Republican senators don't deserve your vote. So just boycott it and don't show up. That led some people to accuse Lynn Wood of being a double agent, a secret Democrat. Breitbart and some other right-wing sites came out and said that he's a plant, a Democratic plant, to try to keep Republicans from voting. So I say all of that to say that I don't believe that that's going to happen. I think you're going to see people turn out en masse because the belief, in my view, mistaken belief that the election was stolen from President Trump. And when I say in my view, I mean as a journalist analyzing the facts, not my opinion. I think that has energized the Republicans here in Georgia, who are going to show up in even greater numbers to vote in the Senate election. And I think the Democrats are obviously fired up because they believe they have a chance to sort of solidify Georgia's purpleness, if not blueness, and just sort of say that there's a new South and there's a new Georgia and we're it. So I think you're going to see really record turnout all over again, even though it's a runoff election.
I just wanted to wrap up. And how long have you been at 11 Alive in Atlanta?
6 years at WXIA, and I can't seem to keep a job. I've worked in New York, Houston, Hartford, Michigan, Illinois, Cincinnati, Jacksonville, Florida, which is more Georgia, frankly, than I think Atlanta is. It's sort of like how Southeast Florida is the sixth borough of the city of New York. It's kind of like that.
Right. Well, and I see, I was looking at your bio, and you've won like every award, every national award from the Peabody, the DuPont Columbia, several Murrow Awards. I believe I saw in the few years you were in Atlanta, you've won more than 100 Emmy Awards.
Yeah, total. They're regional Emmys. It looks something like this. These are the regional Emmys. They're for multiple chapters. A couple are New York City, Boston, New England, etc. But I'll tell you, the awards don't mean anything. It's nice, and they buy you some freedom from your bosses. When you win a DuPont, which is the equivalent of the Pulitzer in television, it's given out by Columbia, the same people who give out the Pulitzer or the Peabody, it buys you a year of leave me alone and let me do my work. Like, they don't want to mess with the mojo. And that's the real reason for the awards. But the real reward is when you actually make a difference. When I got a phone call from 96-year-old woman, Mrs. James E. Blaylock, whom the president had accused of voter fraud. She's an older woman here in Georgia who voted with her married name, which is how she's been registered since the 1940s. She first voted for FDR, and she had people accusing her of voter fraud. She's voted in every presidential election since FDR's last election. And only because she signs her name Mrs. James E. Blaylock and properly signed it on her absentee ballot, the Trump campaign and Tucker Carlson said that James Blaylock had voted, even though he's been dead since 2005. We knocked on her door. We showed she was alive. We showed that her signature matched. We showed that she voted legally. And to get a phone call from her saying, thank you, no one bothered to check. You were the only one who did. You cleared my dead husband's name, a World War II veteran. You cleared his name and you cleared my name. To get a phone call from a 96-year-old woman who had nobody defending her against the president of the United States, that's the kind of reward. And I don't care whether she's Democrat, Republican, independent, it doesn't matter. It's the truth is what matters. And, you know, to go out there and be a warrior for truth every day is the real pay of the job.
That's really what it's about. And you do a terrific job at it. And, you know, I could tell even just the professionalism in your tweets.
No, well, thanks. Every once in a while, I get a little snarky. You know, like today, I said that Sidney Powell's taken another Kraken at her lawsuit. Or you got to throw a little humanity in there every once in a while.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. You have to balance it out, but it's hard.
It is hard. And then the other thing is that, you know, sometimes I'll make one typo, and it's amazing. I mean, because you've got so many people following it now. It's like immediately they're all like, you know, you got that wrong. And I'm like, and then I delete the tweet and they're like, you deleted the tweet. It becomes a whole crisis, you know?
Of like why you deleted it or something, right?
Right, like, right. And then my bosses are like, when are you going to file an actual story? You know, we don't make any money off of Twitter, right?
Well, again, thanks for a few minutes talking to me today.
Yeah, this has been outstanding, Jerry. Hey, look, down in Atlanta, we get a lot of things, but what we don't get is the pizza you can get on Long Island.
Bagels too. Bagels in New York.
True. Yes, no question. It's just not the same, you know. And my black and white cookies too. I can't get those here either.
That's right. Well, thanks again. It's Brendan Keefe again, chief investigative reporter for The Reveal, 11 Alive, WXIA, in Atlanta. Thanks again for your time.
Thanks, Jerry.
President Trump, in a tweet Saturday, December 12th, said, quote, we have just begun to fight. He also ripped the conservative-leaning SCOTUS that had, quote, zero interest in the merits of the greatest voter fraud ever perpetrated on the United States of America. But dozens of cases at every level were thrown out by the courts, citing a lack of evidence and merit. That takes us to my next episode. Renowned forensic psychiatrist Dr. Bandy Lee. She's joined more than 20 other mental health professionals for a book documenting the dangerous mind of Trump. Lee says what we've seen since the election is part of a disturbing pattern by Trump. Premium content from this and past episodes available to members of my Patreon Here Now the News page. Your support is vital to helping me grow this podcast. Another way is leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or sharing an episode. To contact me, there's Twitter at Jerry Varmash, email herenowthenewsjb@gmail.com, and on my Here Now the News Facebook page. Thanks for listening.